no problem at all.
There we go. All right, we are now recording, so welcome. Appreciate your time tonight. And Dr. Picard, if you want to do introductions.
So sure. Thank you, Dr. Burton. So I'd like to welcome today Simon to the seminar. I had the opportunity to meet him a few months ago when we started talking about cybersecurity. So, Simon does something that is very interesting, and I thought that we would have this very different experience today where we talk about what the State Department does. He has a lot of experience, international experience dealing with other countries and so forth. So while he's not 100% cybersecurity, he somehow deals with cybersecurity occasionally. And, you know, I thought he would be a different kind of experience today. So Simon, thank you for joining us today. And again, as we discuss, feel free to talk about your experience with the State Department and other international organizations. And then, you know, we can take questions and answers afterwards. Would that sound fine?
That sounds good to me. Absolutely.
So welcome.
Thank you. I'll just take a few minutes to perhaps introduce myself and talk a little bit about, you know, where I've been, what my experiences have been in government and outside of government. I think I can see some of you, mostly you're not on camera, so but feel free to be on camera if you'd like. I, at least at my company, I encourage my teams to do so. It makes for a better interaction, but no need to, especially if you're trying to have dinner or do other things. So maybe I'll just work backwards, and I wanted to first of all, you know, thank you for having me here. Dr. Bukar is a real mensch, as they say. We had actually talked about an opportunity together, and as a result of that opportunity, he asked me to come speak to you, and it's obviously, you know, it's a pleasure. I've always been better at giving others advice than taking my own advice, and I'm not going to oversell my cybersecurity credentials, but the reason that I started getting to know Dr. Bukar is I am the vice president for Global Advisory Services for a company in Virginia that is a federal contractor. So there are a lot of companies out there that I'm sure you're familiar with, the Booz Allens of the world, the Deloittes, et cetera. Coleman International is a company whose DNA is really founded in supporting the Department of Defense. And specifically the Defense Threat Reduction Agency. And for any of you who are interested in the world of CBRNE, countering biological, radiological, nuclear, chem, and other threats, that's sort of the DoD's key combat support agency. And that's where Coleman's story started in 2004. I joined Coleman 3 years ago, running what was a small business, essentially the single division that did international programs and security cooperation. Cybersecurity falls into that space generally through my lens. But what I do 3 years later is I'm still a vice president for this division, but we've now acquired a few other companies, and it's the same sort of story for a lot of federal contractors. We have grown into a mid to large company with offices in 15 countries, serving a dozen different U.S. government agencies, providing project support, logistics, procurement, et cetera. And I wear a lot of hats. So if we were in a large company, I would probably be very stovepiped and serve one customer like TSA or DHS. But I'm blessed with what I really want to do, which is preparing lots of different meals in the kitchen. I'm both a vice president who oversees different program directors who focus on a variety of agencies like the Defense Cooperation Agency, and perhaps an agency that you know well in your world, CISA, DHS's Cybersecurity Agency. We have about 40 people there. but also DHMS, where we work on medical records for the agency that works on behalf of DOD on medical records with the VA. So a very large reach, but also TSA, DHS, and the Department of Energy. So sort of a wide array. But I am also the program manager for two different contracts at the State Department, very unique and very different. One is for the Counterterrorism Bureau of the State Department, where, of all things, I manage a $12.5 million grant that builds aviation and airport security capacity in Libya. So even though Libya, for those of you who have an interest in that part of the world, is a country that has two governments, is in the middle of a civil war, is beset by COVID, economic tailspin, we have still been successfully working at a number of airports in the East and the West on behalf of the State Department with boots on the ground, providing detection equipment, training, auditors, screeners, and in fact, Libya's first female screeners, because as we speak, female passengers at some of the operative airports don't get searched when they board a plane. And so Libya has been fairly isolated. And so I lead a program that's active there. Happy to talk about that. And then I also manage a program this time for the Political Military Bureau at the State Department that provides embedded national security advisors at foreign ministries of defense. So that's a little bit of a mouthful, but as you know, the U.S. government cooperates with over 120 countries and has close security cooperation relationships with them. And I, on behalf of my company, manage a contract where we compete to provide senior advisors that have some kind of security specialty and that spend up to 5 years working for a foreign partner embedded in their ministry. And so cybersecurity is one of such specialties. And we currently have an advisor in Bulgaria helping create a center of excellence there. But in an update for Dr. Bukhar, we've just received our forecast for that contract, and we will be bidding on positions to provide cybersecurity advisors in Argentina and in North Macedonia. And you may wonder, what's the relationship? And it's actually less exciting than you might imagine. These are embassies, our U.S. embassies in these countries, for whatever reason, have developed relationships with their counterparts in those countries and developed a request back to the State Department to provide an embedded advisor to support in those areas. And then Coleman is one of three companies on a particular contracting vehicle that is able to have the opportunity to bid and provide an advisor for that work. So I'll get back to that. Let me jump back, because I know we only have an hour and I really want to give you a broader target to shoot at than maybe what I'm doing today. I do a whole range of things. In addition to managing others who are program managers and do a range of things, I would regret if I didn't tell you one of the best experiences I've had in federal contracting, which occurred 2 weeks ago. I actually spent 10 days in Dallas, Texas at the K. Bailey Hutchinson Convention Center. And this was about a month and a half ago. The Health and Human Services Department, one of their contracting officers called our contracting lead at Coleman and asked if there was any chance that we could show up in Dallas the next day, hire 400 people, set up operations, and start feeding up to 2,000 unaccompanied children who were coming out of essentially CBP custody and into HHS custody. And so for many of you who might be following, it's sort of hard to avoid immigration as a topic on the news. We actually are running what HHS considers, and this is not actually saying a lot, the gold standard facility. To use HHS language, it's a congregant facility, or it's an EIS emergency intake center, emergency intake service, where the government, who is, I think it's, I'm not going to get into politics, even though I spent a decade on Capitol Hill, was singularly unprepared for this mission of hosting unaccompanied children, and has been renting space in up to 20 facilities around the country to house them temporarily until they are either paired with sponsors or moved elsewhere. And so my role, and we've been doing that. And so we've been providing support to those children. We've been feeding them three times a day, and we've been maintaining their health and security in a very challenging environment. And I have to say, I don't know how much experience any of you have with federal contracting. Typically, the government keeps you at an arm's length, but our operations center is in the convention center, and the government took our space. And so when I was there, there was a thin cordon between us and the HHS government officials monitoring our contract. You can imagine how uncomfortable it was to talk about some of the challenges we were having on the contract. So it's a facility where there are now closer to 900 children, but we have been managing that. Happy to kind of talk about what that looks like. My apologies. I'm going to close my door. My toddler was trying to make an appearance. This is the quarantine life, right? Let me just step back very quickly. Two phases of my career, and then I'm going to stop because I'd rather kind of hear from you if there are particular areas that you'd like me to expand on. I actually grew up abroad in Paris, France, as an American citizen, but a mother working for the United Nations. So I had an interest in international affairs kind of very young. I lived, did my college in Boston, and then came to Washington, D.C. Some 30-some years ago. Grad school there, School of Foreign Service, can talk a little bit about the academic track, although you are at a foremost educational institution, obviously doing what you want to do. A number of jobs, but the two sort of big pieces in my career, a decade on Capitol Hill working in the Senate and the House. I worked for then Senator John Kerry as one of his youngest foreign affairs aides, and then moved over to become staffer and eventually chief of staff to a congresswoman from the East Bay of California named Ellen Tauscher. She actually passed away a couple years ago. She was a sort of a titan in the House with a very singular focus on national security. She represented the East Bay of San Francisco. I don't know if any of you are from California, but that includes most people who don't know the Bay Area tend to think of it as a very liberal area. It is not. It is incredibly diverse. And she had sort of the bedroom community of San Francisco, lots of folks who work IT, bio, pharma. Some of the Metallica folks live there. Walnut Creek is the main chief area. And then specifically to my passion, Lawrence Livermore National Lab, one of the three nuclear labs at part of the National Nuclear Security Administration. And as luck would have it, politics are strange, Travis Air Force Base, the gateway to the Pacific with C-5s and C-17s. So I used to know a lot about refurbishing C-5s and C-17s and those military base issues because I had to be responsible for that portfolio. But my kind of turning point in my career was being handed the portfolio of representing and supporting Livermore Lab and its employees. That district also has across the street the California campus of Sandia National Lab. And so with that, you have the engineering lab of our nuclear complex, and then the two weapons design, or one of the weapons design labs, Livermore, the other one being Los Alamos. There's a lot I could tell you there. That was sort of where I grew up in my 20s, was working nuclear security issues. This was at a time when the Cold War was long over. The labs were trying to find their mission. Obviously, a weapons complex that had been designed around testing that had been outlawed under Bill Clinton. More interior didn't mean that subcritical tests the desert weren't taking place underground, stockpiled stewardship, a lot of programs around non-destructive testing to maintain our arsenal as it was slowly being wound down, but keeping that deterrent. So a lot of those debates, I was sort of in there. And then the congresswoman that I worked for one of the elements of her legacy is she helped create, she drafted the legislation to create the National Nuclear Security Administration. I'm not sure if any of you have heard of it, but it is the agency in the U.S. government whose singular purpose is to maintain our nuclear deterrent. And so based, it's unfortunately a semi-autonomous agency within the Department of Energy. What does that mean? That means it doesn't control its own budget. It doesn't have its own CFO with full authority. So when it gets more money from Congress, it can't always control it. It sometimes goes to other programs at the Department of Energy. But it has the nuclear security remit, meaning that it is supposed to guarantee the ability of the lab directors to guarantee the surety, safety, and credibility of a nuclear deterrent for as long as the president needs to rely on a nuclear arsenal. So I spent a lot of time representing scientists and trying to get money for that facility, got involved in nuclear testing related debates. Believe it or not, there's still people on Capitol Hill who'd like to return to physical testing of nuclear weapons. And I definitely was on the side of those counseling caution in that regard. And then Congresswoman Tauscher, I'm speeding through a lot of different things. I was her chief of staff at the time. She got a call from then Secretary Clinton asking her if she would take on the job as Undersecretary for Arms Control at the State Department. I'm happy to talk chapter and verse about the State Department. Like an awkward relative, I love the State Department. It's a fabulous place. It's sort of a 19th century agency trapped in the 21st century. It's very paper-based, a lot of process, but it is in charge of foreign affairs, for right or wrong. And we took over from the previous administration, George W. Bush and his team, the part of the State Department that deals with arms control and nonproliferation. And I eventually became the Deputy Assistant Secretary managing a series of programs that do capacity building around the world on border security, biosecurity, nuclear security, and chemical security. And there's just a lot to talk about there that I'll perhaps leave for questions. But the State Department is not a very operational agency, but it got involved in some very operational pursuits that I think have had an important legacy in this space of international nonproliferation. One of which, for any of you who followed the tragedy of chemical weapons use in Syria, I was involved on behalf of the State Department with the operation to remove Assad's chemical program. It was a massive international undertaking, working with the Defense Threat Reduction Agency. I actually met my wife during that operation. She was stationed in The Hague, which is the headquarters of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. And for any of you who may have paid attention at the time, there's a couple ways to get rid of chemical weapons. One is hydrolysis, so water-based. Another is incineration. And some of my experts on my team advocated for incineration. DITRA won out, but since no country wanted to host elimination of those weapons after Secretary Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov brokered a deal, temporary deal to remove those weapons, and no country would do this, we actually had to hydrolyze those chemical agents on a ship floating in the Mediterranean. And that was a fun operation to kind of explain to allied countries that depended on tourism and cruise ships and others that there wouldn't be some horrific accident in the Mediterranean. But that was a sort of diplomacy meets national security meets operations, and happy to talk about that. I was actually also involved in the elimination of Gaddafi's remaining chemical agent in Libya there's a facility called Wadan where he had accumulated a lot of his chemical weapons program. And we led an operation, this time all of the State Department by itself, to concentrate, remove, and eventually eliminate some of that agent. I remember sitting in the intelligence space, INR. This is not classified, so I can share this. We had equipped the Libyans with remote markers, and we were watching the trajectory of the trucks moving the chemical agent across the country to a port where we were able to take custody of that material. So why am I here and what are we doing? I eventually decided that after some 16 years in government, I really liked program management. And as with any of you who might have an interest in public service, I left the Obama administration where I served, and along with, unfortunately, 3,000 of my best friends, and we were all looking for jobs at the same time. And while many of them went to think tanks or other things, I decided I really wanted to get into industry. I had managed foreign assistance programs that worked in some 120 countries, and I really wanted to see what it was like to be what's called an implementer, be actually responsible for cost, schedule, and performance of U.S.-funded assistance around the world. And so that's what I do. Cybersecurity, like I said, is one piece of what Coleman is involved in on behalf of the State Department. So I'm kind of marrying up my interests. I have some of the best moments I've ever had in my several jobs has been mentoring and counseling others, editing resumes, giving folks counseling on their next path. And so I'm more than happy to take questions on either anything that I've talked about or anything that I should have talked about and that I didn't. So perhaps with that, I'll stop.
Thank you, Simon. That was quite a career. I mean, I actually just, as you were speaking, I went to look at Ellen Tosher's career. She had quite an impressive life. She died quite young, but it's impressive what she managed to achieve. So thank you for your service. So obviously I'm more interested, since we do cybersecurity, I'm more interested to have you talk in terms of cybersecurity. Could you give students an average, you know, without being specific, talking, for example, of, for example, Bulgaria or another country? What would happen, for example, if a student had an experience in cybersecurity and was to work in a country? Let's take the Bulgaria example, you know, without being too specific, of course. Just to give an idea about some of the challenges that people could have. Is that something that we could do?
Yeah, so it sort of depends in what capacity. So it's always dangerous to get out of your lane. The specific angle on cybersecurity that I've had recently is providing the State Department, in this case, the customer, with senior advisors who, like you, have a deep passion for cybersecurity, but also have an interest in helping countries that don't necessarily have the same level of resources, the same standard operating procedures, the same threat picture, the relevant capabilities, not to do everything that they want in the space, in the cybersecurity space, but to be as interoperable and supportive of U.S. national security interests in the region. And so Dr. Bukhar mentions Bulgaria, where, you know, it wasn't something that was on my radar or certainly my company's radar, but there is an interest because, you know, Bulgaria, obviously with the NATO partnership, being in a region where there are some Russian, Chinese, and other cyber threats, has wanted support from the international community to build up its own capacity. And so Coleman sort of entered the stage along with two other companies bidding on the opportunity to provide some advice there. And so we are in the very early stages of working with the Bulgarian government to create a cyber center of excellence that would meet some of the standards that you're familiar with, and certainly Dr. Bukhar is as well. So if you all were interested in both international security cooperation and in cybersecurity, there are a lot of different types of opportunities. The piece that I can speak to is this kind of niche requirement developed by the State Department in that capacity. Now, I'll also say, you know, I mentioned that we have a contract at CISA, so that's more CONUS-based, so domestic-based. And in that case, we do a lot more sort of advisory services, program support, project management. We're not, on the offensive side, of course, we're purely on the defensive side. I'm not sure if that answers your question, but from a career perspective, the kinds of people we've looked for the State Department have been folks that either have a strong military experience and exposure to cybersecurity or in the private sector. Now, I will complain for a bit. I have to recruit for all these jobs. I have a recruiting team, but they're not, you know, their baseline is fairly general. What I've found, cybersecurity, and this is where you guys all have an edge, is such a new discipline. And sometimes the government doesn't quite know how to ask for what it wants, meaning that they have a prejudice towards former military officers, potentially sometimes at the O5 level, who also happen to be cyber experts. And frankly, that doesn't really exist. Somebody who's had a storied military career doesn't often turn around and say, let me go get a master's in cybersecurity, get all the quals, the certs, the training, and then offer themselves up for this kind of contract. And then certainly working for the government is not, as I think Dr. Bukhar knows better than all of us, not always the best you might have made in your own career. So part of my world is to, or my kind of effort is to kind of navigate that space between, and so we call this informally in contracting, having a champagne taste on a beer budget and explaining to the government what it can actually get for the money it's willing to spend.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Can I elaborate on what you said, Simon?
Of course.
Can I mention more or less? So this job, we talked with Simon a while ago about a possibility in Bulgaria, and I would have potentially been responsible for creating for an entire country, helping them develop a cybersecurity policy. I mean, I don't know if you can imagine in terms of the opportunity that it would be for someone to go and help create an overarching policy at a country's level. Of course, you have to go with what the country wants. So it's not what you always want. It's not always the best thing because at the end of the day, you advise. But it's something that was potentially extraordinarily interesting. Does everybody understand how, you know, there could be a variety of roles? Some of them that we talked in previous weeks are CISOs where you control things. Other jobs are working for the DoD, supporting installations and so forth. But other jobs may be where you help create policies at the country level, which is a complete different ballgame. And Simon is the kind of person that could, if you were to be interested and have the experience, could help you get into this kind of position. So, Simon, did I say that correctly? Trying to present this with a slightly different angle than what you said. Is that accurate?
You did an excellent job, and I know we're focused on cybersecurity. The other positions that we support potentially, I currently, as we speak, have an advisor in Antananarivo, Madagascar, responsible for developing that country's maritime security strategy. As Dr. Bukhar mentioned, we have another advisor in Peru embedded with the Peruvian Army developing their disaster response strategy. And we have finally an advisor in Dakar, Senegal, helping that country develop a more interoperable military capable of joining United Nations peacekeeping missions in Mali to counter the threat of Boko Haram. And in each of those jobs, just like Dr. Bukhar said, there's a very broad mission to help that country develop a national strategy and a capability to deal with a particular functional area, as I described.
So some of the things you need to be aware of is if you go and work with this kind of jobs international, is that you need to be very sensitive of your customer differences. I mean, while many countries dream to move, I mean, people move dream to move to United States, when you're dealing with foreign governments and so forth, not everybody is going to accept that you just present the way it's done in America and you expect everything is done the American way. I had this kind of experience at NATO, and you want to be very cognizant of the fact that while America rules the world, at least for now, or let's say this, we still do, many countries are very, very sensitive about being told this is the way and that's it. Do you want to elaborate on this, Simon?
I'd love to. And I was looking a little bit to the left, not because I'm playing brick breaker, but because I had a few notes that I thought I'd love to share at this kind of intersection. I've had to give lots of speeches and lots of comments, but if I could just kind of distill something that might be interesting to you, if any of you eventually decide to get into international capacity building, these were sort of lessons learned that I had that I was delivering to the Department of Energy, and this will take 3 minutes. A couple of things. This was, again, talking to the Department of Energy. One bit of advice, understanding how engagement fits in a partner country's interagency. So what do I mean? The interagency is the collection of government agencies that work together. In the U.S., it's all the, you know, State, Department of Defense, Department of Energy. Other countries kind of mirror that setup. But I was very much struck by the comment by the chief of police of Moldova, a very small country in Eurasia, who I met with 3 years ago, and who said we were encouraging him to work more on arresting nuclear smugglers, so smugglers of nuclear material, sort of unsecured nuclear material. And he said, you know, sir, with all due respect, I can arrest these people all day long. I know where they live, but our justice system is corrupt. And every time I arrest somebody, a corrupt judge lets them go. And to me, that was just the best encapsulation of you solve one problem, but it's, you know, you're building a house, right? You might have finished the kitchen. You've got to look at the basement. Number two, sustainability of what you're trying to achieve. And this will apply to cybersecurity and elsewhere. The United States is not very good at thinking through the sustainability of its programs before launching in them. I think for any of you who are familiar with Afghanistan, some of USAID's programming, some of DOD's programs, a lot of capacity that's been left behind that might not have been as well thought through. Every agency has that kind of history there. Third, designing an exit strategy. So, you know, Dr. Bukhar talked about advising the Bulgarians. That doesn't end up being a lifelong job that becomes a contract that lasts 1 to 5 years. What can you actually achieve out of that engagement in that period of time? And how do you leave that country more independent and less dependent on whatever you've taught them to do? Three, if you ever do join the government and start working on cyber problems or others, make sure to find ways to deconflict training and assistance that's being provided to the same country. When I was at the State Department in 50 plus meetings with agencies that were providing similar assistance because they just weren't talking to each other there and so on. Forum shopping. Typically, there's all kinds of countries that receive U.S. assistance, and some of them are very good at it, meaning they'll say yes to both assistance from the United States and from the European Union and from the Japanese and from the Koreans. And I was in Jordan, I've been to Indonesia, and I've been elsewhere where we were trying to help countries develop capacity, and we were deconflicting very similar assistance being provided by other countries, which can lead to some negative effects. I'll skip a couple of these. Having a policy framework is important. And then last thing, because I think this is kind of a curiosity, Burma, which is now called Myanmar, this is not at the secret level. That's another country that used to have a biological program, so biological weapons program, and has the ingredients to do bad things with it. I oversaw a program that does security at those facilities. I was chomping at the bit before I left government to go do something about it and provide assistance in that regard. And we never were able to do it because another part of the State Department had a different political agenda and didn't want to provide that assistance until other kind of parameters have been met. I'll even tell you one more story on Syria chemical weapons. There were factions within the State Department between those like me who wanted to get rid of those weapons and then consider what to do with the weapons scientists that might not have been actually responsible for launching those weapons, but had the custody. There's a department called, part of the State Department called DRL, which is Democracy and Human Rights and Labor. They were looking at war crimes being brought to those people. And so you might have the same agency looking at the same problem from two completely different lenses. There was part of the State Department, which is mine, which is how do you work with those scientists to ensure you have your arms around the entire complex, perhaps restore them to some other role because that country just doesn't have a functioning bureaucracy. And then a part of the State Department whose mission is entirely the pursuit of war crimes and who had different objectives. So anyway, I hope it's not too much of a digression, but if I were to try to give you one data point or one consideration as you pursue cybersecurity, you're never doing it in a vacuum. Either others are doing the same thing, others are working in the wrong direction. You're working with a partner country that might not be understanding what you're saying. You may have one mission and it may end up being executed in a completely different way. So being an active listener, having good peripheral vision will always help you no matter what you do.
Yeah, and I can comment on what Simon said. When you work with the government, you're going to be dealing with a number of different agencies. First, there's going to be different contractors who have competing projects. Pretty much every contractor wants to have a bigger footprint and have the other contractors lose their contract. This is perspective number one. Perspective number two, there's organizations such as MITRE. MITRE is MIT Research Entity, as well as MIT Lincoln Lab, again, MIT, I guess you're seeing the pattern, which are quasi-government entities, and you potentially have to deal with those guys. And, you know, they're saying they are government pretty much, and, you know, they may work for you, but may not accept to work with you. So one of the big challenges is trying to make everybody work together and get things done. And this is potentially a big issue that is not easy to solve. So do we have any questions from anybody so far? Okay, no questions so far.
Brendan has one there.
I'm sorry?
Oh, he says I have none. Sorry, I thought you said I have one, Brandon.
And it can be about anything you want.
Yeah. Oh, Tyler's raising his hand, though.
Tyler, go ahead. You're on mute, Tyler.
Maybe he didn't mean to raise his hand. Don't know.
Well, I cannot.
I have a quick question.
Sure, go ahead.
So as far as cybersecurity and government policy go, the way that we're developing into, you know, maritime and space and all that fun jazz, how would you look at, from your perspective, how we're developing our cybersecurity programs and what sorts of policies might we be needing to put into place to continue progressing, I guess, towards the future?
That's a real good question.
it's a great question, and it's very broad, and I might not be the right person to answer that question. You know, again, my lens tends to be how do we help other countries meet the standards that they can achieve, depending on the region that they're in, depending on the threats that they face. And so, you know, Bulgaria is in this region where there's a Russian and Chinese threat. I was focused a few months ago on Croatia and some of the disinformation challenges that it faces and how to train its it's public affairs folks at their Ministry of Defense to deal with Russian disinformation, which is all connected to cybersecurity, economic disruption, and other efforts that we engage with you know, covertly and overtly with some of our enemies. And so I don't know that I can answer your question broadly because it is so case specific in my world. And I would also say from a U.S. government perspective, your question is a good one, but it assumes that there's a unity of purpose between, say, DHS, the State Department, Cyber Command, and others, when in fact every agency is governed by its own authorities, its own mission, and they all answer to my former boss of the U.S. Congress. And I wouldn't insult Congress by saying that it's a very forward-thinking entity. And so you might have a broader strategy or a broader vision, but I wouldn't say, and certainly cybersecurity is such a new field generally compared to some of the other elements of national security, that I don't think we're yet in a place where there's a common acceptance of broad-based standards at a national level per agency. But Dr. Bukhar can correct me. I'll give you one very quick anecdote. I was around when Cyber Command was set up. I was at the State Department, and the State Department answer to Cyber Command was, hey, we have to do something. But what they did was very State Department. They created a cell under the Deputy Secretary in the number two position at the State Department. And he realized that to truly grapple with global cybersecurity and the State Department mission, there were 50 different bureaus and offices within the State Department. Let's say, just think about it, the folks that work on finance, on commerce, on trade, on national security, the regional bureaus, depending on which part of the world you're worried about for related to cyber threats, all had a stake in whatever the new policy would be, and a lot to lose from the centralization of a U.S. approach to that threat. And I remember him creating an org chart for the State Department so that there could be some counterparts to Cyber Command at the State Department. And it wasn't pretty. There were about 50 different entities under a dotted line answering to the Deputy Secretary, which, if any of you are familiar with bureaucracy, is a recipe for zero ownership of a problem. And so we're much farther along. At that point, the White House created a cyber czar, who I think would be best suited to talk to what the current administration's national policy vision is. But that has changed over time. Under the previous administration, you'll recall the head of CISA was fired after he dared certify that the elections were sound. This is the world we live in. We have a contract at CISA. We stay very much on the technical level, but if there's any insecurity at the leadership level, it makes it hard to kind of develop a national level strategy. So I know I haven't really answered your question, but that's been sort of my experience around that issue.
Okay, I've got two other random sort of not really related, but kind of related questions. So as far as the disinformation around the world and the various countries goes, how do we as cybersecurity professionals potentially detect and then prevent some of that disinformation going around the world, even within our own borders?
I love it. So what a great problem. So, you know, listen, I was not a disinformation expert, but just like anything in the Washington, D.C. area, you throw a rock and you're going to hit a subject matter expert on something, on North Korea, on nuclear energy, on, you know, name your thing. And there's obviously a whole community of experts who work on disinformation. There are not-for-profit organizations that focus on that. I'll tell you a little bit about the piece that I got involved in at a project level. It was with Croatia, where they had a very specific interest in getting U.S. assistance to help their public affairs and media team for their military have a better ability to detect and respond to disinformation threats from the Russians. And think about that problem. This is a country where the Ministry of Defense was in the hands of a pro-Russian bureaucrat. This is a country that's much closer to Russia than we are. So any strategy you develop for them had to be a very careful one. The further away you are from a country that you care about, the harder it is to help it deal with a threat that might be on its borders. But what we found was that, and so what did we actually do about it? So you can't do everything with a limited budget. What we did was help develop a workshop with some local non-governmental organizations, and including a couple. We never got to execute it, but I'll just between us, I'll share some names. There's an NGO based in the Czech Republic called Kremlin Watch, and their whole focus is helping countries deal with Russian disinformation on their borders. And they helped create a cell at the foreign ministry in the Czech Republic that tracks misinformation from Russian agents on their government platforms. And they have a lot of best practices that I channeled to help develop a curriculum. And so we had folks from there who are willing to teach, and then some others who are more on the technology side who are able to talk more on that side of the equation. And we created essentially a 4-day workshop with a Croatian subject matter expert to kind of be there to give the local flavor. And we were ready to deliver that. The contract was eventually canceled. I don't think the problem went away. So in my answer to your question, there isn't a universal one-size-fits-all approach to disinformation. It's part education, it's part technology, but it's also understanding the nature of the threat and where you sit. That threat is going to look very different than elsewhere.
So Simon, may I comment for a second, Simon?
This is your show, please.
I'm going to give a more IT answer. There is a SANS class, which is Forensic 578. It's taught by the CEO of Dragos. Right now, I can't remember his name. Do you remember Dr. Burton? He came to speak to us. Robert Lee, thank you.
Yeah, Robert Lee.
That company became a multi-billion dollar company in the last 6 months. Okay, it went through the latest thing. The evaluation is now over $1 billion. And this guy teaches a class which is cyber intelligence. And what the purpose of that class is to merge pretty much forensics and intelligence. So, and I think I mentioned this in one of my class, if you take the event, North Korea incident a few years ago, you may remember that there was a movie from Hollywood about two reporters going to North Korea to try to kill Kim Jong-un or whatever his name is, and the North Korean allegedly disliked it, and they hacked into Sony and released all of the movies from Sony and so forth. Now, the media likes to immediately blame someone, and they said, well, of course, it has to be North Korea that did it, because who else would do it? Now, of course, you know, you can always go for the easy answer, or you can search for the truth. Now, is it because someone used a keyboard that is in Korean that the perpetrator is Korean? No. I mean, if you think about it, a French person could very well have tried to deceive everybody else by using a North Korean keyboard to try to blame the Koreans. It's what they do in terms of disinformation. So there are classes about this. I've talked to Dr. De Burton about doing a class like that, which would try to merge intelligence and cyber intelligence. We're not there yet, probably one of these days, but know that there are classes and programs. You just need to be very good in terms of forensics. You need to be able to go and see what happened, what is the evidence, and then you will potentially learn the intelligence side, trying to understand who has a benefit in doing something. Very, very interesting field. It's probably the future, but just know this potentially gets very highly classified, and it's potentially dangerous for your life, because you're potentially finding that certain countries are tampering with other countries. And, you know, when you reveal that another country has done certain things, there may be consequences. I assume everybody has heard that there was an incident with a refinery in, I think, Texas or Louisiana. And this is impacting pretty much all of the Northeast. And apparently the FBI has mysteriously stated that it was Russia that did it. You know, this is the kind of things that you could do in terms of cyber intelligence. So, Simon, go ahead. I'm sorry I spoke a lot.
No, I'm happy to keep chatting. I don't know if you have a hard stop in a few minutes, but I'd love to hear from other students if there's any other questions that they'd like me to tackle.
So yeah, one thing that if there's no question in the meantime, I'm going to mention something else. I'm going to share my screen really quickly for everybody to just see. Because I'm sure no one knows where Bulgaria is. Can you see my screen?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, Bulgaria is this little country, and you see Russia is here. I don't know if you can see my mouse. So one of the things that intrigued me when Simon and I were talking is there's this pipeline of oil that goes through Bulgaria, and it goes towards Serbia. It goes towards Greece and Italy, and the other way around, it goes through Turkey. Now, what do you think would happen, and this goes towards cyber intelligence, if Russia was to shut down the pipeline in terms of cybersecurity? It's very possible that a country such as Bulgaria, which is dependent on this gas, may have to just do what Russia says because they're dependent on the gas. Does everybody see that? So you potentially have to, you know, look at things that go way past cybersecurity. I mean, this is definitely looking at intelligence that, if you're still here, I don't see you anymore on the screen, where, you know, I was trying to understand what are the threats. Remember, the first thing that you do in cybersecurity, you look at what are your assets, what are the risks, okay? The risk in Bulgaria is that Russia tries to intervene. Hope everybody doesn't mind that I gave this example. Yeah, SANs are extraordinarily expensive events. That's why I hope that one of these days, we provide a class in cybersecurity intelligence, but, you know, maybe in the future, but not right now, Ted, unfortunately. So, Brett,
all good. I'm always curious.
Brett, you ask a question: is it ethical for the U.S. to interject in a country like North Korea, which prohibits and monitors the use of the internet? What do you think, Simon?
To interject in a country,
to intervene, probably.
You mean to sort of promote cyber freedom in North Korea? You mean just sort of getting involved in those issues? Is that what the question's focused on?
Ted, would you like to comment on the question? Well,
that was Brett.
Oh, sorry, Brett.
Yeah.
He's I see. So trying to you know, prevent firewalls, try to open up their ability to share information internally. I mean, whether it's ethical or not, that's been sort of a bipartisan pillar of every administration is openness of information. And beyond the United States, it's part of the United Nations Charter that, you know, information should be shared freely. So it's not so much should the U.S. do it or not. It's sort of every member state of the United Nation has that along with, you know, women's rights, democracy, and other things. Now, are they all achieved? Of course not. I think that the bigger challenge is what leverage does the United States have in North Korea? And I think on so many issues, all roads go through Beijing. On most issues that we care about, whether they're human rights, the nuclear stockpile, their conventional arms, and other programs that they may have. So I think the U.S. view is absolutely anything that can be done to sort of allow the North Korean people a better ability to access information from outside North Korean borders is certainly legitimate.
Yeah, and just a little comment for everybody. Keep in mind that right now, statistics show that 60% of worldwide espionage, I mean, business espionage, I mean, corporate spying is Chinese related. I'm sure, you know, some people are not going to like it, but it's the statistics. 60% of it comes from China. And I run a little program here to look at traffic, who was pinging me. And one thing that was very interesting is that on average, I'm pinged every 6 seconds from China. Russia, it's every 6 minutes. And United States is every 4 minutes. So it gives you, it gives me a perspective. It's my opinion, okay? It's not DOD, it's my personal experience. On average, the Chinese are, you know, considerably more active in trying to spy on Americans. And keep in mind that their mindset is 200 or 300 years, right? Simon, I'm sure you know about this. The Chinese have a very long-term view in terms of politics and worldwide affairs, where they don't mind investing over the long run. So, you know, everybody's kind of in play. You, even you at home, while you may think you have nothing special, you know, right now you may have nothing special, but the Chinese may be still interested to know what you're doing and so forth to, for potential blackmail purposes sometime down the road.
Looks like Tyler, did you want to ask your question now? Sorry.
Yeah, can you guys hear me? Sorry about that.
Yep.
Hey, Simon, first of all, thank you for taking the time to provide your insight for us. You obviously have a lot of experience working with a multitude of government levels and agencies throughout your entire career. To that note, I have a little bit of experience working with some of the demands of the 18 Acres and the White House Communications Agency. And I've definitely seen within those agencies some knowledge gaps, some skill gaps that are required to take care of the urgent demands in cybersecurity. And to kind of combine that with your experience, what are some of the greatest gaps from like a program management and contract fulfillment field in filling those needs for cybersecurity? Like, what are the skill sets that you struggle, I guess, to recruit and retain in those areas? I'm sorry, that was a little bit.
No, it's such a great question. And I'm going to give you a cop out like I feel I have for a couple of these questions, because they're so sector specific, they're so customer specific, and they're so mission specific. You know better than I in your program, what are the kind of certs and standards that are required to have sort of a fighting chance of being recognized as someone with expertise. Without divulging too much, my experience with the State Department on the contracting side was that the government didn't quite know and still doesn't quite know how to do something as simple as developing a position description for the kinds of people that it needs to support cybersecurity objectives, right? So what are the three qualifications, years of experience, et cetera, that are necessary? And I've seen government agencies create position descriptions and recruit the wrong people because they have a prejudice towards, in my case, it's been folks with significant military service thinking that that's going to play better, when in fact, cybersecurity being a younger discipline has its own kind of inherent logic that should be understood. So, you know, some agencies know what they're doing. CISA knows what it does and what it wants. And so when they ask us for certain kinds of people, it's crystal clear. The government has an inherent difficulty across cyber fighting with the private sector, right? For qualified folks to support their mission at the salary levels that the government can provide. So there are a lot of companies that do very well outside of federal contracting. My world is federal contracting, and it's always a hard time to find somebody with, say, 8 years of cybersecurity when that specialty hasn't existed for that long And then also happens, though, by the way, to have a decade of national security experience in the military or in diplomacy or elsewhere. So I'm always trying to create a Frankenstein type person. And so recruiting for cybersecurity is tough, not just because there's not a lot of you out there. There aren't, compared to, say, doctors, physician assistants, engineers, and others. You have the benefit of being in a limited pool of highly skilled candidates, but you also have to struggle with the fact that the government doesn't always know how to recruit for that specialty. And so I'm constantly in efforts on behalf of my company. I think I saw some folks talking about PwC, obviously a bigger shop, but more focused on consulting. We do program management, logistics, and procurement. We have a very small cyber practice area. Our specialty really more is on program management, logistics, international services than it is on cyber. But there are, you know, like you said, PwC, Booz Allen, and other places that have a very well, Deloitte, that have a very well developed cyber capability. And the challenge is, if you're in the private sector, you know, Dr. Bukhar mentioned some success stories, right, about folks that are and companies valued at high levels. You know, if you're in the private sector, you're constantly trying to anticipate future needs, and you might invest in a whole different practice area and then discover that the market's taking you in a completely different direction, right? It might not be national security, it might be energy. And so your investment is sort of all for naught. So I think for you guys, I'd continue to study hard. I mean, you're at Purdue, you're where you need to be. You're learning the kinds of skills that you need. I'm happy to talk to folks offline about specific requirements that I'm aware of. But you're lucky enough that your customer base is kind of limited, right? You know, not every agency has a cyber element or capacity yet. And so it's pretty straightforward in terms of looking for where you might want to go, at least on the government side.
It looks like Derek still had a question. Do you still have a question, Derek? Thank you, Sai.
Sure.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. So yeah, thank you for your informative information, Simon, for the government. So I was wondering, I've noticed a lot when just looking at these government jobs, it seems it takes a longer process to hire people, especially because of security. You know, and governments are they're wanting people, but they also are wanting people with the capabilities of being able to be. So is it hard for your recruiting and just your broad departments to hire people because of that security clearance? And maybe they're just not eligible, or it's just a harder process. I mean, how does that work and tied to trying to get in to government work?
That's an awesome question. There are two types of government jobs. There's legitimately government jobs where you're working for the civil service, right? And where you're actually working for the government as a government federal employee. And those jobs are all listed on USA Jobs. And so that is a long, arduous process. I've been a part of that at the SES, senior executive service level. And so you can go to USA Jobs, to the website, do a search for DHS, for example, or State Department or DOD specific agencies, and see what they have there. And I think just spending a few minutes scrolling through the position descriptions and the job openings there will give you a sense of what the government is asking for at various levels. That's one category. The other category is federal contracting, where you work at a company like mine, and then you provide experts like you to the government for a time-limited opportunity to serve in a role supporting a government agency. So why do contractors exist? So the government outsources capabilities that it doesn't have indigenously, right? So I'll give you an example. I oversaw 5 different offices when I was in the State Department. 4 of those were program offices. In each of those program offices, there was only 2 or 3 feds, civil servants, who managed an army of contractors simply because the State Department didn't have expertise in biosecurity, chemical, nuclear, or cybersecurity, and had to go immediately to the private sector to find folks who are willing to do that. So what kinds of people exist in your market? There are folks who are coming fresh out of school who may not have a lot of professional experience, and they're going to be able to compete for some kinds of jobs that are perhaps more junior. Then you have people that might have worked in the private sector for a while and can parlay that skill set into a federal contracting position. But typically, you're going to want to have a broad experience beyond sort of the technical lens that you might have. So in terms of applying for jobs, your initial question was how long it takes and some of those challenges there. Any job that requires a security clearance can take a while, right? A job that requires a security clearance at DHS, where there's a whole process called suitability, multiply that by three. DHS has just cornered the market on challenging, cradle to the grave hiring processes. We have folks that were recruited, but we can't put in billets for months because they go through some inane internal process within the government at DHS. But the verification of a clearance doesn't necessarily need to take forever if you have one. Getting the clearance can take a while, but what I can also tell you is once you have the clearance, you become even more marketable for other jobs. And so let's say you have one job with, so in my example, I had a TSSCI clearance when I left the State Department, and I was able to negotiate some percentage of my salary because I came to the private sector with that clearance, and I transferred my clearance from the State Department, and it was held on a contract now at Coleman International, and they pay the cost of maintaining my clearance, and I'm right in the process of doing a sort of a re-adjudication right now. And we have ways of upgrading people's clearances. I've been in the process in the past of hiring people that didn't have quite the right level or their clearance had lapsed, and so we have a mechanism in our company to try to get you a temporary clearance and then move you forward. So it really, again, depends on the government agency, depends on your situation. Do you have a clearance or not? If you don't have it, you have to apply for it. We'll certainly take a while. But there's jobs where you don't necessarily need one. So it just depends what you're trying to do.
To comment on what Simon just said, and Simon, thank you again for everything you said so far. So to give some perspectives to people, I understand that there's going to be a new regulation currently, with the new government. They're going to limit the number of SES. SES is Special Executive Service. It's the equivalent in the military to a general officer. So it's level above GS-15, general pretty much. They're going to limit the number at 1,000. For the entire United States. So there's very, very few SES. I mean, of course, there is a significant amount of them, but don't think that getting an SES job is that easy. Second, salaries in the government are typically not that good. There is a statistic that the average government worker makes about 100 grand plus 36,000 in benefits and other things. In comparison, the average contractor in the United States gets cost to the government 199,000, so pretty much 200,000. So as you can see, there is a considerable pay gap between government employee and non-government employee. So be aware of that. And while it's possible to get an SES, SES are considered political appointees. You serve pretty much at, if please correct me, Simon, but you serve, you can be removed from office if for political reasons, pretty much. Is that correct, Simon?
There's just one adjustment I'd make. There's two kinds of SES. So I was the kind you described, which is a non-career senior executive service. So I was term limited. I was a political appointee in the Obama administration. But the senior executive service in the civil service is the highest level of government service you can have. It is above the GS-15 level. So if you're familiar with the general scale, you know, you can start in the GS-6 and 7s and work your way all the way up to 15. Above that, as Dr. Bukhar described, there's a kind of the narrow ether of leadership as the senior executive service that exists since, I think, the 50s or 60s. The purpose of the SES as a core of senior executives was that, and you know, it either works or it doesn't. I actually have both of my in-laws are SES, one at the Department of Interior, and then the other at the Consumer Financial Protection Agency. The premise is that they can move from agency to agency, bringing the highest level of management acumen from program to program. So they have an internal ability to move around. They're on the highest pay bands that exist in the civil service. Typically, if you're a GS-15, again, at the highest level of civil service, you can take a particular candidate development course, but you're already in the government, and then you can then move on to these kind of more limited opportunities. But once you're an SES, you're kind of, it's as high as you can essentially go. And there's that, at least theoretically, 40, 50 years ago, is that the idea was that you could move actually within agencies and solve high-level strategic problems and potentially move from agency to agency. So that hopefully a little bit more flavor there for you.
Thanks, Simon. But again, you know, keep in mind that there's a limited amount of SES. It's equivalent to a general officer. So, you know, it's not something that everybody's going to be able to achieve. It's something you have to be really good at what you're doing. And in essence, Simon is equivalent to one of the general officers that previously attended those events. So, you know, please keep this in mind because while it's achievable, it's going to take you a while to achieve that kind of level.
So I see a question about the Libya program. Can I just say a couple words about that?
Go ahead, please.
Yeah. So the question was sort of what we were doing there and how might you apply your degree there. So that program, very briefly, is a grant for the State Department to build aviation security capacity, both at the national level, developing a national strategy for the Libyan government to have around aviation security. So just like there are strategies around all kinds of problems, pandemic response, cybersecurity, every country, according to the International Standard Setting Organization, which is called ICAO, based in Montreal, has to have a number of objectives that they meet at the national level. And then we actually work at the airport level, installing detection equipment to make sure that the Libyan Civil Aviation Authority is able to detect and eliminate potential contraband material, weapons, and other types of things. So is the question was it about applying cybersecurity. We don't actually have anyone who has cybersecurity expertise on the program. However, ICAO, the International Standards, actually Annex 17 of ICAO, which describes aviation security, because aviation is obviously bigger than that. Aviation safety is a completely different topic. Anything that goes on inside the cockpit and within a plane is not something we touch. We touch everything that happens landside and in the airport, and specifically in Libya. There are some cybersecurity requirements for aviation security. And it just hasn't been something we've spent a lot of time with on this program, simply because the Libyans can't even control their territory. And so being able to be involved in cybersecurity is something we would probably look at in the next year or so, rather than something they have very limited equipment. It just so happens that over the next few months, we're going to be delivering ETDs to them, explosive trace detection equipment, so that they can find explosives in luggage. They have one item, one machine, an ETD machine that the United Kingdom gave them some years ago, which they don't use. And so we're sort of at that level of security building there. But it is definitely something we'd like to do more of. And having somebody on our team that can spell cybersecurity is probably a useful thing. You're hired. You yeah, forgot the part where you negotiated the salary, but I'll take you.
Yeah, I don't know if you noticed his picture. Ted is a big air balloon person, so he's very, very interested in aviation of all kinds.
I'll definitely dig in. That's what I'm here for.
Well, I'm not sure that having a balloon in Libya may be a good idea. So I think there's missiles and stuff, and since they're probably heat-seeking, may not be a good idea to have a boiler on top of...
You may be friends with the right militias. You just never know.
Yeah, nice big target there. Awesome.
Well, so, Simon.
Yeah, thank you. Dr. Bukhar, go ahead.
Simon, I'd like to thank you. I think we went a little over 5 o'clock my time. So thank you very much for spending an hour plus with us. You know, I hope everybody benefited from seeing this different perspective in public service with international, this international aspect that we had not had so far. Hope everybody enjoyed it. Again, Simon, thank you very much. I am interested to talk about Argentina. And with that said, Dr. Burton, would you like to conclude?
Yes, thank you so much, Dr. Bukhard. And Simon, I appreciate your time tonight so much. Just so you know, we have recorded the meeting, obviously, and then we turned it into a podcast. So I will send you the link to the podcast website that it gets posted on in a few days or so. If you want to share that with anyone, you can. But we totally appreciate you coming and sharing your thoughts and experience and perspective. And I'm sure a lot of people are excited about the possibilities of getting into government service, as you have kind of shared. So,
well, if I can just thank you both, Tina, Dr. Bukhar, for your own, you know, support for your students and for what you're doing on it. I come from a family of educators, so it means a lot to me that you're spending your own time in this pandemic environment trying to make everybody's career prospects as strong as they can in this field specifically. This is actually the best thing, the part of my day that I enjoy the most, when I'm able to kind of give back or have a conversation and just see what people care about these days. So it was really an honor to talk to all of you. Don't be discouraged. Always be positive. Make a lot of friends. Continue to network. In that spirit, I'm happy if either of you want to share my email with anyone here. And I'm also available on LinkedIn if folks want to chat with me. But thanks again for the time. It was a pleasure for me too.
Absolutely. Yeah, we definitely encourage everybody to connect on LinkedIn. Thanks, Ted. And he put that in the chat too. So you'll see a whole bunch of new connections tonight, I'm sure.
Sounds great.
Thanks so much. Everyone have a great night. The recording will be shared soon. Have a good one.
Have a good one.
Cheers, everyone. Good night.
Good night.
Good night, guys.